Every day is existential for an authoritarian regime.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center and a Bulwark contributor. I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C., and an Atlantic contributing writer. Elliot, are you battening down the hatches for Snowmageddon?
Oh, you bet. We've been stockpiling cocoa, and my wife has been baking batches of cookies. One great fortune that we have is we live about 75 yards from three physically vigorous grandchildren who have committed to shoveling us out in return for grandma's goodies. So we await the snowstorm with confidence. What about you?
Well, I've already informed my better half that my cardiologist said I can't shovel snow anymore. So, you know, it's all going to be down to her, and she's ready for the challenge. So, I will give you my nominee before we turn to our very distinguished guest for today, for this week's Jackassery. There's so many, you know, potential options here. But in particular, I was struck by, and we've picked so much on the Secretary of Defense, I wanted to, you know, be an equal opportunity abuser. And so I want to, you know, give a shout out to the Secretary of Treasury, who explained so cogently on the Sunday talk shows when asked what emergency was being used under the president's international emergency powers to impose tariffs on foreign countries in the case of the European countries over Greenland. He explained that the emergency is that we have to prevent an emergency, which is, of course, double talk and nonsense. But so that you know, this is a guy who helped George Soros break the Bank of England and the pound, but you know, there you go.
Yeah. Well, he actually, you know, it's interesting. His language has been deteriorating. I mean, he's just gotten kind of cruder and more loudish with every passing month. I think that's what working for Donald Trump does for you. There's so much jackassery around. I will say, I just read an article by a very distinguished academic who insisted that Trump had actually mastered Davos. He had complete control. He was playing three-dimensional chess. You know, he got them exactly where they wanted him, where he wanted them. This is all a cover for us taking down the Iranians. And I thought, you must be smoking dope. But my main candidate for the jackassery of the week is Trump's Board of Peace, which includes the following countries: Belarus, Morocco, Vietnam, Kazakhstan, Hungary, Armenia, Egypt, Kosovo, Pakistan, Paraguay, Albania, Uzbekistan, Bahrain, Qatar, and Indonesia. So that's going to substitute for the United Nations. Apparently, as of at least this morning, and kind of an angry Truth Social post by the president, Prime Minister Carney and the Canadians are not invited.
They've been disinvited, and I'm sure they're really crushed by that.
There's a penalty to pay for crossing President Trump.
Right. And I would also note that President Putin is considering joining, hasn't decided, but he very magnanimously will pay the $1 billion entry fee from some of the $5 billion frozen assets here in the United States, which, God willing, he will never, ever see a penny of again. Which brings us to our guest for today. We're very lucky to have Professor Stephen Kotkin, who is truly one of the great historians actually writing in America today. He is currently a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and at the Friedman Spohley Institute at Stanford University. He is, of course, been professor at Princeton for well over 30 years, and now a professor emeritus of history there. He is the author of a number of books, but in particular, Magnitogorsk. Metallic Mountain, I think it was.
Magnetic.
Magnetic Mountain, about Magnitogorsk, which is a book about Stalinism as civilization, from which I profited reading long ago when I was still in the Soviet affairs business. But more to the point, I think one of the great towering works of history written in the first quarter of this century, which is his ongoing trilogy of volumes on Joseph Stalin, two volumes of which have been published, one of which we await. And for today's purposes, the author of a recent article in Foreign Affairs, The Weakness of the Strongmen, What Really Threatens Authoritarians, Professor Kotkin, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Thank you for the honor of the invitation.
Can I begin by asking a question? I very much share Eric's high regard for that, particularly this extraordinary biography, which I urge our listeners to read. You know, since you wrote that article, there was major public upheaval in Iran. And of course, our snatch of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, but that regime still stands. In both cases, actually, the authoritarian regimes still stand, despite an internal shock on the one hand, an external shock on the other. I was just wondering if you could talk to us within the framework of that article about what those two events suggest or reveal.
Yeah, so the argument I'm making is that these regimes are all powerful and brittle at the same time. They have inbuilt vulnerabilities that can be exploited, even though they have massive repressive apparatus and they can shoot and kill their people like we just saw again in Iran. They fail at everything across the board. The only thing they must succeed at is to suppress political alternatives. So if you're pushing up against them, the thing you want to do is widen the aperture for political alternatives. The way that that happens best is to divide the people with the guns. To divide the people with the guns, they're already at daggers drawn. They hate each other. They're jealous of each other, very rivalrous. If I steal the property, then you can't steal the same property. And so there's just a lot of hostility inside this massive repressive apparatus. They also often have patriotic feelings and they worry how the country is going down the drain because of bad leadership, corrupt and incompetent leadership that they see all around them. And so there's opportunity there. It's not easy, but that opportunity comes from exploiting those divisions within the people with the guns and trying to co-opt them onto a pathway of a different future. So it may not be an immediate transition to democracy. It may not be that the, quote, democratic opposition, unquote, is swept into power. But if you get the democratic opposition in power, you still have the problem of what to do with all those people with the guns. And in a country like Venezuela, where you have jungle, you could have a permanent insurgency against any rapid democratic transition. In the case of Iran, you have at least 10 million, probably more, hardcore members of the regime. Now, that's a country of 90 million, but still, that's a lot of people who may be willing to die for the survival of that regime. So unless you can get figures who control big pieces of those repressive apparatuses and militaries and would march them towards a transition out of self-interest, you're faced with the difficulty that the regimes can hang on. They can suppress their people, kill them, imprison them, drive them out of the country into exile. As long as they can keep some elements of the security forces who are powerful from breaking away and trying to form a different future. So that's the dilemma in every single case. And that dilemma has yet to be solved in either the Iranian or the Venezuelan cases. Again, we're not very good at this. This is really difficult. Still, it can be done.
So just a follow-up on that, and then over to Eric. Why should one think that, let's take the case of Iran, if you have some faction of the Revolutionary Guard Corps that takes over, either Khamenei dies or he's pushed out, or you know, he becomes a figurehead. Why should we think that there's fundamental regime transformation when one group of bad guys with guns take over from the current bad guy who controls all the guns? I mean, why should we think there's a different trajectory that begins to emerge once that happens?
There might not be. It's often the case that ideologically opposed regimes replace each other and partake of similar repressive mechanisms and institutions. The Shah fell, and the Shah's secret police was hated, and the anti-Shah revolutionaries reconstituted a version of the Shah's hated secret police, which had tortured them when they were in the opposition, and now they used to torture the opposition. So you're right, Elliot. It could well be that despite a rupture, there is quite a lot of continuity, because whenever you break something, you rebuild it, you rebuild afterwards with the shards of what you've broken. So a transition doesn't happen naturally. There are a lot of built-in pathways, tendencies, structures that lead you back in a similar direction, even under, as I said, an ideological opposed regime. So you need to intervene into that and change the incentives for people. And so if you have some type of judiciary, and Iran has just a very powerful judiciary, including way down in the locales where they enforce the laws and the repression of the Islamic Republic. If you lop off the top of the regime, you're still left with those Islamist juridical structures deep down in the society. So it's not just about removing the leader. That could be a part of it. It's also about changing the incentive structure, the performance, maybe even introducing alternatives to the repressive apparatus all the way down to the village level. So if you do nothing about those Islamist courts, they're then available for whatever replaces the current leadership to mobilize on their behalf. And so that's a problem we see again and again from each case. We don't really learn about institutions and societal structures, and we tend to think about regimes through individuals or leaders. Again, that's important, but a broader, deeper understanding could help us with some areas of leverage, intervention. So you want to lift sanctions. You don't lift sanctions for nothing. You lift sanctions based upon behavior. So you provide the opportunity, the incentive. You say, if you move against this regime and you stop doing X, Y, and Z, we will remove sanctions in the graduated process as we watch your promises, whether they're fulfilled, what your actions might be. And so if they're interested in survival, if they're interested in, that is to say, their personal survival, their personal property, the career opportunities for their children, they could well be incentivized to move against their own regime and potentially to alter some of their behavior because of self-interest, but also let's appeal to patriotism, because everybody knows that the current Iranian regime has destroyed the country. And many of them, even the ones with the guns, are worried about the future of their country, not solely worried about their own safety hood and their children. And so there's an opportunity to intervene if we know what we're doing. But of course, that requires attention, patience, multiple tools, not just the military tool, and lots of other things that are generally in short supply when it comes to government and busy people running big portfolios in an American government.
Yeah. I mean, I think Elliot and I both that resonates, I think, with both of our experiences. I couldn't help but think, as you were talking about the continuity between the Savak and the secret police under the Ayatollahs of the Russian example, of course, with the Okhrana and the emergence of a secret police state in the Soviet Union shortly after the revolution. So obviously
the prisons are the same, Eric. I mean, they use the same physical structures. The archives are the same. And the personnel carry over, including, again, those people who tortured the Islamists. They're available to torture the people who were in the regime with them on the Shah's side. And so it's a global phenomenon. We get it. But combating it requires attention to institutions and especially incentive structures of people who are running institutions or could be running institutions. So you can get bad people and change their incentives and get better behavior. And you can get good people with bad incentives, and lo and behold, the bad incentives trump their norms or their values. So it can be done. But of course, we have many examples where it was not done or done badly. And so the caution, humility, all the things that you guys know well from these other examples.
Yeah, humility, not a quality that one sees in abundant supply inside most governments that I'm familiar with. I wonder if you might, we've talked a little bit about Venezuela and Iran. They are certainly authoritarian powers. They're not the main ones that are challenging the U.S. I mean, Iran has got a kind of special case, but Russia and China and their tightening access are the real kind of story here, I think. North Korea important as well. You talk in your article in Foreign Affairs about the rise of these authoritarian states, and you point out that a lot of this couldn't have happened without the complicity of the United States and the West. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, in the aftermath of the end of the Cold War, the rise of these states and what opportunities may have been missed along the way to try and constrain them?
So we had a theory, and the theory made sense. The theory was that even your worst enemies, Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan under Hirohito, even your worst enemies can flip and can join your alliance system, your global economic order, your trading system. In other words, you can defeat your enemies and co-opt them, change their behavior, and make them your allies. And this was a remarkable story. The post-World War II transformation of West Germany, just stunning. I mean, this was a Nazi regime like yesterday. And then in the case of Japan, we hit them with two atomic bombs, and then the firebombing, conventional firebombing of Tokyo in some ways was just as bad, maybe worse. And then a few years later, blink your eye, and we sign an alliance treaty with them. And then, of course, not only are Japan and West Germany transformed into democracies and partners of the United States in the blink of an eye, but South Korea, Taiwan, two former Japanese colonies, start out as authoritarian regimes, and yet they democratize over time. And in addition, they're strong allies and partners of the United States. So this is the theory. The theory is that, geez, if you can do this with Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, you can do this with anybody. And so in 1993, when Bill Clinton comes to office, the Soviet Union has collapsed. Eastern Europe is emancipated. It's just the South African apartheid regime goes down in a negotiation, and Mandela spent 27 years in prison, is eventually elected the president of the country. It's just astonishing the changes, and you have this theory in place that had worked previously in those cases. So Tony Lake gives this speech in 93 called From Containment to Enlargement. So we're not going to just do this for the non-geographical West, meaning North America, Western Europe and the first island chain in East Asia, we're going to do this for the whole globe. And we can do this because we've done it before in those other cases. And then it becomes part of the first Clinton administration national security strategy. And so here you have China and Russia. Russia is one of the, by far the largest successor state to the collapsed Soviet Union. It's trying to manage this implosion, this institutional chaos. Can we help them? Can we help transform them the way we did West Germany and Japan? China's a little bit of a different case. It did not collapse. They didn't have an implosion. The communist regime repressed successfully from their point of view the June 1989 Tiananmen occupation of their central square with significant casualties. And so the Chinese regime is still the one that had been founded in 1949. But nonetheless, the idea is the same from our point of view, that if we engage them and we make them part of our world order, not fully on the security side, but certainly on the economic side, we can do this. And so there is a history that was compelling at a certain level. The problem was it was the wrong history. The history of these places is different. It's Eurasian landmass empires, civilizations that go back a lot longer than the history of the United States and that have been autocratic through thick and thin, through revolutions and ruptures and just everything Eliot was talking about earlier. So their autocratic landmass civilizational identity empire is a stronger history. And that's a history that we thought could be trumped by this other history of folding them into our order and practices. And we were wrong. In the case of China, there's even a deeper or stronger element pushing in the wrong way, which is communist reform. Communist reform is what destroyed communism. When you begin, like in Hungary in 56, Czechoslovakia in 68, or Gorbachev in the 80s, when you begin to liberalize politically, not economically, but liberalize a communist system politically, you end up destroying the communist monopoly and poof, it vanishes. So the Chinese might have done that. They might have had a reform, communist political liberalization. They didn't. And they certainly were not going to have that after Gorbachev because they saw what happened. Deng Xiaoping was never so inclined. He told one of his sons that Gorbachev was an idiot. But nonetheless, there were others in the Chinese regime who thought that political reform, opening, loosening of the communist censorship and could work, could make the regime more stable. Once they saw Gorbachev did what he did and lost the regime unwittingly, that was the end of that. So these two autocratic landmass empires that predate America by millennia in the case of China and by several centuries in the case of Russia, we're not going to do this. And so that's the history we should have applied and didn't. Instead, we abetted their modernization in all realms except politics, meaning they were going to stay autocratic, but they were going to borrow whatever they could from us, including technology transfer and everything else, in order to make themselves stronger because they didn't want to be responsible stakeholders in a U.S.-led order. They wanted their own, either Sinocentric or coercive sphere of influence in the case of Russia. And so we abetted that with the wrong history. Now, that history happened. We just misapplied it in the case of these regimes. North Korea is a little bit different, and we could talk about that. Iran, of course, was on our side until the late 70s, until 79, and then flipped. It's not inconceivable, as Eliot was probing, that Iran could go back the other way and become an ally or a partner of America in the Middle East again. I think we could see that in our lifetime. It's far from that right now, but conceivable. And so what you're really talking about is the Russia-China piece, like you said, Eric, with the North Korean satellite there that's straddling the two of them and playing the two of them off against each other. So despite doing that, however, we have still a lot of tools and possibilities to counter them. And that's what the Foreign Affairs article tried to show.
You know, one of the things that I I think is very interesting about the way you're framing this is the importance of thinking about the deep history of the states that you're looking at. And in the case of Russia, China, and Iran, I wouldn't say the same thing of Venezuela. You're looking at some pretty deeply rooted cultures and civilizations, which are bound to limit what you can do. I was wondering if I could draw a line between that and this other article of yours in Foreign Affairs on Russia's five futures, where you lay out, I think in a very convincing and interesting way, a range of possibilities for what Russia could become, ranging from chaos at one end to something that's quite malignant. I mean, what we've got now is very malignant, but is at least equally malignant, with a very interesting possibility in the middle, where you say, well, look, the best possible thing that could happen is that they go through an evolution rather like that of France. And you cite one of my favorite books, Alexis de Tocqueville's The Ancien Regime and the French Revolution. So I was wondering if you could walk us through your assessment of Russia first, what it is that you think makes the Russian regime so precarious, and then talk us through some of those possibilities.
Yeah, so a lot of people will argue on the basis of culture. And culture is sort of equivalent to DNA. So if Russia is like this because of certain cultural proclivities, this is it. It can never change. It's DNA. And so therefore, the only thing you can do is permanent containment, permanent Cold War. There's no possible transformation. You'll hear this view from the Baltic states, which have lived under Russian occupation for really long periods of time, heavy repression and attempted destruction of their nations in some ways. So for them, it's a existential threat right in front of their face, and it's a proclivity, it's a DNA genetic code argument. You might have made that argument about England in 1600. You were hearing a lot about divine right of kings. You were hearing a lot about the centrality of the monarchy and the role of the church in supporting the monarchy, despite some occasional rifts between them. And so you could project forward from England in 1600 and you could say, you know, this thing is genetic, it's DNA. They're never going to crack this absolutist monarchy. Similar in France, right through 1788, you could have made the same argument, and one could go on and take other cases. The point is clear. And so it's not cultural necessarily. Russia has a culture, there is a civilization, but it's a choice ultimately, and it's a choice that can change, or it's a trajectory that can be broken, as it was in the case of England, which turned out to invent a version of constitutional order that's been really enduring, despite having had this divine right of kings. The French case is more complex because they went back and forth and back and forth, and the French Revolution originally culminated in Napoleon, not in any type of enduring constitutional order. And so people ask me, can Russia change? Is this DNA? And my answer is yes, it can change. If you're thinking about democracy, what you're really asking is, can Russia become France? No countries are alike. All countries are different. But if there's any country in the world similar to Russia, it's France. The absolutist monarchy, heavy bureaucracy of the old regime, the crazy revolutionary culture that is very hard to assimilate, the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and I could go on in the similarities. Of course, there are differences in size and geography. And so if you look at Russia and people say, can it become a democracy? I say, you're asking me, can it become France? And your judgment about whether it can become a democracy is your judgment about how far it is from France right now. And it's very far. And so then there are some other trajectories which are rooted in Russia's sense of itself as a providential power under God with an historic mission in the world, a special mission to carry out, that it needs to be among the great powers, if not the great power in the world, because it's a special place ordained by God, Eastern Orthodoxy. But it can't realize those ambitions. And so there's a gap that opens between the ambitions and the capabilities. And then to manage that gap, or maybe even overcome it, they use the state as a coercive instrument to force modernize the society with violence and statist economies to try to be competitive with the greatest powers in the world, which is a place that they regard as deserving for their culture. So that's the choice we have. It's a multi-century model. It's different under Peter the Great compared to the later czars. It's different under the Soviet Union and Stalin. It's different under Putin now. It's not identical, but it is a recognizable pattern, and it's a choice. The problem with the choice is every time they use the state as an instrument to force modernize, to try to close this gap between their ambitions and the capabilities, the gap with the more powerful countries in the West, they go farther away. The gap widens. They end up with personalist rule rather than a strong state. They end up conflating the survival of the personalist regime, like Putin today, with the survival of the country. And so it doesn't work. They don't close the gap. They don't bring their capabilities up to the level of their ambitions. And so what they've chosen to do now is to become a kind of subordinate or even vassal state to China as an instrument to help them manage the gap between their ambitions and the capabilities. So they refuse to be a vassal state to the West, and they've embraced being a vassal state to China in some ways. Of course, China, not Russia, decides who's a vassal to China or not. And so China could at any moment actually abandon Russia to its fate, which we may live to see. It's not on the cards right now. But the point being is that it's a geopolitics, a perpetual geopolitics, which that foreign affairs article was entitled. That was the title. And it's a choice that they make so they could reduce their ambitions to be a providential power, a power under God, to be the first ranked power. And instead of imposing these costs on their own people and on their neighbors, they could decide, like what France decided, invest in themselves. Sure, a proud culture, a culture with aspirations, considers itself a civilization. We all know France well, but France is a rule of law country with very high quality of life for its people. And that's a choice that the French made when their empire revolted against them and they lost those wars or capitulated in them to hold on to the empire. Russia could make that choice and very well may make that choice in the future. The current regime has doubled down on this multi-century strategy of coercive use of the state to try to close the gap between aspirations and capabilities and has failed miserably. That's the trajectory that they're on. It's looking more and more like Putin, if he survives for a while longer. His life expectancy for Russians who turn 60 is about 80 years old. And so he's coming up against that trajectory, although he has better physicians than the average Russian, we can all assume. Anyway, so we're afraid that he's going to continue to pursue this chimera, subordinate Russia more and more to China, but also mortgage or destroy Russia's future. Russia's 21st century economy lives not in Russia, but in Tel Aviv, in Yerevan, Riga, everywhere but Russia. They have the lowest level of robotization of any middle or higher income country. I mean, this place has made itself into a basket case, but one thing it can do, overinvest in the military, overinvest in the secret police, and be a spoiler in the international system. Sadly, that trajectory would need to be significantly interrupted by something either internal or external to change it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you were in Russia around the same time I was when I was serving in the embassy from 1987 to 89. And when it all came down, the one thing you heard from Russians is we want to be a normal country.
Yes.
So the aspiration was there at some point. It was unfortunately political class that, you know, was governing didn't actually, you know, execute it. I wonder if we could.
Well, I mean, Eric, that's a really good point here. What did they execute or not? Because, you know, earlier you made the point about Savak.
Yeah.
The secret police under the Shah, and then Savama, the first secret police under the Islamic Republic. So on January 1st, 1992, the kind of first day of the new Russia, they had 7,000 judges. And they had 750,000 employees of the KGB. So that's their inheritance. Now they're going to do rule of law. And of course, Eric, those 7,000 judges are communist judges. I mean, they're hatchet men and women.
Right.
And what are you going to do with the 750,000 KGB agents? Some of are drivers or telephone operators, but a lot of them are thugs. And you either co-opt them into a new system or they're going to co-opt whatever you're doing for their purposes. And of course, the latter is what happened. And we got a former KGB agent on top of that system, and he's taken it in the direction he did. But so even if the will was there, the difficulty of managing this institutional recombination when those shards are so heavily in the wrong direction. So this is what should cause concern about Iran and Venezuela, or China for that matter. We saw this in Iraq, of course, for those who hated Saddam, and he was an evil person, and certainly there's no way to justify the survival of Saddam in power from any moral or international law even. I don't understand why international law could protect somebody like Maduro, who's destroyed that country. But the point being is that you need to work on that layer of the society. So Russian society was ready for that transition. Just like you said, Eric, normal country. That was by far the most pervasive sentiment at all levels of society. But the institutional inheritance cut the other way.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about, you know, the interpenetration of the Okhrana with the revolutionary movement, which then gave rise to what you described so brilliantly in the first volume of your biography of Stalin. And then, you know, in the late Soviet period, you had the interpenetration of the security services with organized crime in Russia.
Yes.
And that, you know, metastasizes into the kind of, you know, personalized, you know, criminal state that we have, you know, now. You know, one of the most arresting things about your article is the description of the vulnerabilities of these authoritarian regimes. And you've touched on some of it. You've talked about the competing security institutions, which is a, you know, potential point of fracture. You've talked a bit about the paranoia of these regimes. Could you talk a little bit more about the other, you know, I think you described five different vulnerabilities of the authoritarians. Could you maybe walk through the others a bit?
Yeah, quickly. I mean, there are five strengths that are also vulnerabilities simultaneously if we understand how to exploit them. So they have this gigantic repressive apparatus. And in fact, it's multiple. It's not just one. And it's not just one on purpose, because they're afraid if it's unified, it could displace the leadership of the regime. So they have to keep the repressive apparatus a little bit off balance at cross purposes. Antagonism between the secret police and the military, antagonism between the anti-corruption units and the other aspects of the security services. And so therefore, there's this inbuilt hostility that we were talking about. So they're gigantic and they are heavily armed. And they have no qualms about killing their own people. But at the same time, they're roiling with resentments and animosity potential recruitment because they are the ones that didn't get the promotion or the property, the stolen assets. So that's the first one and the biggest one. The second one is what I call cash flow. We generally mistakenly think that these authoritarian regimes require GDP growth to survive, so-called performance legitimacy in the poli-sci literature, or social contract where the population gives up its freedom in exchange for higher standard of living. There is no social contract. If the GDP doesn't grow, it's not like the people can enforce the contract in a court of law and tell the regime you violated the contract. That's why they have a big repressive apparatus in case they don't grow the GDP and the people get angry. What they need, however, is cash flow. They need to be able to finance themselves. And that often comes from underground. Mother Nature, 300 million years ago, put stuff underground that we use for our global energy system, known as hydrocarbons. It can also be diamonds or gold, or it can also be hacking crypto exchanges and all sorts of ways that they generate cash flow. The more they generate cash flow in that fashion, the less they're dependent on their own people, whom they're afraid of. And the people generally despise them, and they know this at some level. And so cutting off the cash flow, so the cash flow is a strength. All that money that Putin gets from the hydrocarbons that he sells abroad, oil and gas, and all the money that the Chinese regime gets from exporting manufacturers, which is just a huge source of support for the Chinese regime, global exports of manufacturing, which depend on allowing them to sell into your free society. So that makes them vulnerable. And we failed to exploit that vulnerability. On the contrary, Europe is still today spending more money on Russian hydrocarbons than it is spending on supporting Ukraine in the war. Still to this day, almost 4 years into this war. And so that's that cash flow is number two. We could go on to the rest of them. Another one is control over life chances. So the more the regime can control whether you get a job and what kind of job, whether you get housing and what kind of housing, whether your kids go to school and what kind of school, the more they control your life chances and your family's life chances, the less room you have to maneuver. And so it's hugely powerful. This is what the difference between a regular authoritarian regime and a totalitarian regime. They control life chances to a very great extent. So therefore, if there's a private sector for housing, a private sector to start businesses, a private sector for schools, if you can introduce or support areas that are not statist, which affect people's life chances, then of course there's more room to maneuver. And if you criticize the regime, you don't necessarily lose your house, your job, your children's spots in schools. So this sociological dimension, control over life chances, is another big and important one. And then there are two more, but you get the point. The point being is that they are sources of regime strength, but they're also sources of regime vulnerability, which is why I say they're all powerful and brittle at the same time. If you understand them, they know that themselves. And that's why they have this paranoia. Every day is existential for an authoritarian regime.
And it's why they spend as much on internal security as they do on external.
The Chinese military budget is smaller than their domestic security budget.
So that leads me to the question, you know, it seems to me the way you've described this, there's always the extreme case. The extreme case is collapse, chaos. How does chaos happen when you are dealing with states that are deeply institutionalized, the way you've described, and which now have these very elaborate apparatus of repression, which is empowered by technologies like facial recognition and databases and all that stuff? I mean, clearly these regimes fear collapse at some level, but how can collapse actually happen when they have, you know, both the repressive apparatus and the kind of the institutionalization that allows them to get such a grip on society?
Yeah, that's another really good one. All these questions are really difficult. I don't know how well I'm doing in short space to answer them. Really challenging. Maybe, who knows, people will read the Foreign Affairs article. Shout out to Justin Vogt, who's my editor and just is a magician as an editor. We all depend on really great editors, and this podcast will be the same.
Just parenthetically, I would say amen to that, and that's why I don't do a Substack. You know, we all need editors, but that doesn't get you off the hook.
Yeah. So with the so-called chaos is the threat that they use to preempt change. And they say, you don't like us, but it'll be much worse. It'll be anarchy, chaos, civil war if we go. So you may hate us, hate our guts, but do you want civil war instead? And most people will say, actually, no, we don't want civil war instead. So the Chinese communist regime, the Russia Putin's regime, they're very good at this threat of chaos as a way to, preempt some of the upheaval that could overturn them. What you see, however, when you use the word institutions for them, is that the institutions are not stable. They're not run by regular rules and regulations. They're not impartial civil service bureaucracies. They are instead unbelievably corrupt. There's a quicksand nature to their institutions. They're gigantic in size. They're way oversized on a per capita basis, but they're not as regularized as we tend to think. The ones on the economic side can be a little bit stronger in terms of regularization, rules, and procedures. The ones on the repressive side can sometimes be regularized and sometimes not. And it's a kind of trade-off that they make because, as I said, the more they allow them to be strong, the bigger threat that they pose to their own regimes. So what you see is when the leader goes, whether through natural causes, right? Xi Jinping will die. Vladimir Putin will die. Khamenei in Iran will die. These are all people who are on the wrong end of the actuarial table, even if they have good physicians. Stalin died, Mao died. I remember Franco died. He didn't die on Saturday Night Live. I don't know how many episodes. It opened every episode with Franco.
He's still dead.
So anyway, the point being is that there is a kind of whirlwind that they reap potentially, not because they lack institutions, but because the institutions are not what we understand institutions to be, right? In the United States, we do a lot of harm to ourselves, and somehow the institutions demonstrate a resilience over time that shocks people. I mean, it's been 250 years. Well, it will be 250 years since the Declaration this summer, and then not quite 250 years since the actual institutionalization of the Constitution. But you guys get the point, right? Institutions are not one thing all over the world. Even if they're larger in the authoritarian cases, they're not as stable. So you can get an every person for themselves inside these regimes. You can get them turning on each other. You can get them fleeing. You can get them stealing each other's property. You can get all sorts of behavior that enhances a chaotic post-leader circumstance despite the size of these institutions in these regimes. So again, what you need is some control over that process by co-opting strong people who are insiders who agree to assert some level of control over the guns as part of a bargain to move towards an eventual elected transitional government, maybe you get a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which doesn't prosecute them, but helps people, as it were, acknowledge the crimes that were committed by them and in their name and get to a better place. So you see the Trump administration in Venezuela trying to do some version of this. They have the vice president. They were talking to the vice president before they snatched Maduro. Whether that vice president, Rodriguez, is able to assert that level of control over the people with the guns, and or whether she's willing to enter into some type of bargained transition with a real election, a free and fair election. The opposition won the last time. They could well win again. But you then still have those people you don't want going to the jungle, as we were saying earlier. You don't want a permanent insurgency, even if it's a minority. And so that's the trick of avoiding chaos, is managing those people who can then manage the ones under them and ensure that you don't get either the civil war version or the insurgency version. It's really hard to do. Very few cases have been successful. And certainly from the outside, it's really hard to do. Having said that, what do you do with someone like Maduro? How many people did he murder? The economy contracted 75% in the last decade. I mean, Nazi Germany lost 45% of its economy and it went up in ashes. That was 45% of GDP. This is 75%. And you have 8 to 9 million people driven into exile. I don't understand how international law is supposed to protect something like the Maduro regime when people say it's against international law to take him out. And I say, that's an interesting, what kind of international law is that? But at the same time, preparing for something better, still not on the cards yet, although I can see them thinking, certainly Secretary of State Rubio thinking about how to get some insiders to make sure we don't have the civil war or the chaos or the insurgency in the jungle. But we're still a long way in that case. And on the Russia-China pieces, right, managing them as continuing authoritarian regimes is more the challenge. We're not going to be able to pick off their leaders or cascade anti-regime revolt in those cases. But we are able to contain their behavior by hitting them where it hurts, these five elements of their strength that are also vulnerabilities, pushing them onto the back foot, getting us back onto the front foot. You know, Cuba falls because we cut off the free oil from Venezuela. Iran implodes. And all of a sudden you get a cascade that the Trump administration would take credit for, but of course is caused by longer term structures and longer term changes. And then maybe that puts the Russians and the Chinese more onto the back foot, depending on the rest of our policy. You know, so it could happen that there's a more positive outcome. And it could also happen, as you guys are suggesting with your questions, that things get significantly worse.
You talk in your article about something that's been much bruited in the pages of Foreign Affairs, among other journals, which is authoritarianism here at home and a challenge of the Trump administration and its clearly authoritarian tendencies, or at least some tendencies. You're pretty upbeat about, as you suggested in some of your earlier comments, about the resilience of U.S. institutions in the face of all this. I desperately want to believe that. So, help convince us that that's the case. And then we will let you go on a unusually upbeat, positive note for this podcast.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in the American experiment and its trajectory, not because it's an article of faith, but because of studying the history. And even more than studying just American history, comparing it to the other history that I've studied and written about extensively. Nothing teaches you more about freedom, its necessity, and its resilience than spending your life studying unfreedom. And so when people talk about fascism, I actually know fascism. And I got to tell you, there's nothing that I'm looking at today that is remotely evocative of actual fascism, of millions of shock troops in the street wearing brown or black, of gigantic prisons for people who think differently or because their religion, who they are, what they were born. There are a lot of things in America that disappoint me. There are a lot of things in America that we could talk about on this podcast that you guys talk about just about every week that are beyond disappointing, that are concerning. But what I see is flaws, misbehavior, disappointment, rather than doom, the end of American democracy, the end of the American experiment. Let's remember that Arthur Schlesinger Jr. wrote the book, The Imperial Presidency, in 1973. So this is a problem we've been dealing with as a republic for a very long time. Now, Schlesinger didn't single out Franklin Roosevelt, the ultimate imperial president, for criticism, because Schlesinger liked the programs that Roosevelt did. And Democrats generally like state power and presidential power when they hold the office. And Obama used to say, you know, I have a pen, when the Congress wouldn't enact some of his desired programs. And he issued a lot of executive orders, which are not provided for in the Constitution. I have a pen. In addition, he killed a lot of people with drones in places like Afghanistan. And those extrajudicial killings were justified as we were at war and other things. So there are a lot of phenomena I see right now that I've seen before. The anti-federalists in the 1780s were talking about avoiding the imperial presidency and the Caesarism that would be inherent in a presidency like that. We got lucky, as everybody knows, with George Washington agreeing to step down after only two terms. So this is a problem that's inbuilt, turbocharged by the New Deal, and turbocharged even more by America being a global superpower responsible for a world system. And so President Trump comes along, and he uses the tools of this imperial presidency, and he couldn't get away with it if the Congress were doing its job. If the Congress were the actual Article I branch that we all know it to be from the Constitution. So again, I see a lot of things that maybe I wouldn't like to see as a personal political preference, but I see a lot of things I've seen in American history, whether it's Andrew Jackson or we could go on. And then I see the difference between the current president in the United States and Francisco Franco's regime or Mussolini's regime, or even Orban in Hungary, and I could go on. So again, this is not to validate or justify. I'm not a member of either political party. I have personal preferences as a citizen, a voter, and a taxpayer, but this is an analytical approach that comes from the study of history and the comparison of our freedom with unfreedom. As disappointing as it gets, it's something to cherish, not lose faith in. We are citizens, we're empowered, we have agency, we can change things we don't like, and we can elect or not elect representatives. We have court system, we have an open public sphere with podcasts run by Elliot and Eric, and there's just a lot of hope in all of that.
Hear, hear.
Amen. Well, thank you, Stephen Kotkin. It's been great having you. There's a ton of stuff we talked about in the green room we didn't get to. So I'm if you're open to it, I know we'll want to have you back at some point, well before you finish the next volume.
Let's let your audience recover first from this one, the PTSD, and then we'll see about coming back. But thank you again for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.